This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. Good afternoon. I'm Chris Nolte. On the program today, we will find out more about Methodist Hospital's North Lake campus is receiving verification as a Level 3 trauma center from the American College of Surgeons. We'll have Jennifer Mullen and Dr. Ruben Rutland in the studio to talk about it. We'll also bring you a feature from our folks with Indiana Public Broadcasting about what do you do if you happen to see a pothole in your neighborhood and you don't want to necessarily wait until the city gets around to fixing it, and you do it yourself. Well, that's the case in one person doing the actual work. And we'll also as well have IUPUI Professor Patrick Rooney with us to talk about an article he's put online recently on the question, should everyone deduct their charitable giving from their taxes? That and more coming up. About 2 years ago, the officials at Methodist Hospital's North Lake campus in Gary started the process to be able to get their Level 3 Trauma Center officially accredited with the College of Surgeons, American College of Surgeons. Well, that has finally taken place. Officially, the word came out in the last couple of weeks that the Methodist Hospitals has that status, and we'll find out what that means for not only the hospital, but also for Northwest Indiana, as far as medical care is concerned. We have in the studio Northwest Indiana surgeon Dr. Ruben Rutland, who works closely with the Trauma Center at the hospital, and Jennifer Mullen, who is a registered nurse and is also the trauma program coordinator at Methodist Hospitals. Thank you both for being with us today.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
Well, Jennifer, I'll let you start things out here. If you will, tell us a little about the procedure that the hospital had to go through with the American College of Surgeons. This is very complicated and it's very technical, and I went through the information and I had to figure out, well, how can we explain this to the average person? But that's part of the process, that it's all kind of melded together, that even though it sounds very technical and it is a very technical process, what will come down to it is better service for anybody in Northwest Indiana that happens to need it.
Absolutely. So let me give you a little history about trauma care in Northwest Indiana. The state of Indiana itself as a whole is very immature in regard to trauma system development, but they've been working pretty tenaciously for the past, I would say, 5 to 6 years to establish some rules that help a traumatically injured patient get better care. One of those rules is a triage and transport rule that says if you meet a specific criteria as far as your injuries go and you're within 45 minutes of a trauma center, you should be transferred to that trauma center. Mm-hmm. There's also a rule that's called in the process of ACS verification. And what that process does is allows to a hospital that has the intention of becoming a trauma center and has the foundation of a trauma program in place to submit their application to the state to become state designated as a trauma center. We submitted that application about 3.5 years ago and were granted in the process status as a Level 3 Trauma Center in 2013, just exactly about 3 years ago. Mm-hmm. But ultimately in the state of Indiana, the American College of Surgeons Committee on Trauma are the people that come in and say, you are a trauma center now. And it's a fairly exhaustive process. You have to put about, I don't know the exact number, I should have counted, but I would say it's a close to 200, 250 criteria you have to meet.
Yeah.
And you have to have all of those things in place, everything ranging from having a trauma surgeon like Dr. Rutland at the bedside within 30 minutes, having your OR available within 30 minutes, having your trauma care guidelines in place, having your nurses and your doctors trauma trained. So that's what we've been working on. And we had our visit in May for our verification. Mm-hmm. And we got the stamp of approval on August 11th.
That's
so
great.
We're very proud.
Dr. Rutland, yes. You've been working here in Northwest Indiana for a while. And you know what the situation is. And the problem of Northwest Indiana not having a full-fledged trauma center has been going on for a number of years, and which is in large part why so many cases could have stayed in Northwest Indiana, but they end up going to Chicago or Chicago suburbs. Tell us a little bit about the problems that you run into and how this now, with the status of the Level 3 Trauma Center at Methodist, is going to help.
Well, the Trauma Center is very needed in the community. You know, besides the three highways that we have going through, sometimes we get patients from different areas, from assault as well as from gunshot wounds. And so a lot of these patients was being transferred out, and some of our population can't afford to make trips over to Chicago just to see their family members. So we're trying to bring that back home. You know, we have patients who are injured in the city. We try to bring them back. And I should say before we move on, Methodist took care of trauma patients well before. What Jennifer and I did is to come in and streamline the system to take a lot of the variability out of it. What we saw when we first got here, you have great emergency doctors, but some felt more comfortable with trauma and some felt less. So they used to activate the system at different times. And so what we did is come in and put a guideline in to say, this is what we're considering a trauma. This is when all hands on deck needs to be on. This is a standby. You don't need as many people. And we just kind of streamlined the system to make a good system better.
Does it turn out that, for example, if you want to call it that, traffic accident that does have injury, maybe with only one or two people involved, that doesn't maybe necessarily qualify unless they're a very, very serious accident with very, very serious injuries, I guess is what is discovered by the first responders. It'd be different than if you had a full-fledged emergency. If something happened, a number of people were hurt and the injuries in a number of people were serious, would that kick in that level of trauma where you'd have to be able to go through the injuries and sort them out and get them taken care of properly?
What you're describing is kind of like a mass casualty situation where you have several people coming to the facility. What we do is we work with EMS and we triage patients. You know, as a trauma center, we want to get the sickest. If you have some people, what we call walk-in wounded or people who is not as severe, they may be better served going to a regular hospital in this instance. You know, the research shows that you have a better survivability when you go to a trauma center. But you can't overwhelm the trauma center. So just prime example, you know, you can't get 10 extremely injured patients at the same time to a trauma center. You're just going to overwhelm your resources, whether you're a level one or level three. So we asked our EMS to say, send us the sickest, and then for the other patients that can benefit, that level does not reach the need of a trauma center, can they go to a regular hospital?
They'll still go to an emergency room, and they'll still be treated as an emergency room patient. Yeah, it's a little different, the status. And you say if you have something that's as common like that, I suppose that probably that the most average cases are ones where you're not overwhelmed like that, but it's still a pretty serious situation, and that's where the trauma center is best helping.
Absolutely. We have two defined levels of trauma care. So those levels, we have our highest, most critically leveled, and then we have our mid-level. Each level has a defined team response. So if somebody comes in and, for example, they've been in a car accident and they have a very low blood pressure, and we have a high suspicion that they're bleeding somewhere internally, that's the team that is all hands on deck, like Dr. Rutland just said. We have a surgeon there, OR's on standby, anesthesia has a heads up, blood bank's coming, CAT scanner's getting cleared so we can image the patient. And then for the lesser critically injured people, we have a modified response where the ER team is running that patient and will contact all the resources as needed. So it's a very efficient way to use your resources, but to deliver the level of care that a patient needs.
That is Jennifer Mullen, who is the trauma program coordinator. And we have with us in the studio Dr. Reuben Rutland, who is one of the trauma surgeons at Methodist Hospitals, Northlake Campus. That is the center now that has an official, at least official, according to the American College of Surgeons, Level 3 Trauma Center. And it's been in operation for several years, but this new accreditation, does it put it in kind of like the gold standard, I suppose, of trauma centers, as it were?
Well, I'll have to say yes.
The reason why, as
trauma medical director for the hospital and working with Jennifer as the program coordinator, you know, one thing that we have to do is every trauma patient that comes into the hospital is reviewed. And our main question is, could we have done anything better? And we always question ourselves, even with the best run, you know, finely tuned machine, I think you always have to ask, can we do it better? Mm-hmm. And we meet and we're critical of each other. You know, if it was decided that you could have done something better or faster, we say that, you know, this was done well, but you know what? Let's do it better next time. And it led to nothing but to better trauma care for the region.
Now, I guess the last question I have to ask of you is to not necessarily get your opinion, but and your roles is how you work there at the trauma center with the impending changeover. where the Methodist hospitals, North Lake and South Lake campuses, are going to become, if things go well, part of the Franciscan network. Will that change anything as far as you know for the trauma center? Will that make it easier on you folks? Or will you find that you'll still be, maybe you'll be expanding maybe even to the South Lake campus if necessary?
Well, I think that's all yet to be determined. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's a lot of what-ifs in that sentence, and I know Dr. Rutland and I are both committed to keep doing what we're doing until they tell us to do it a different way otherwise. But I think that, in a way, it would offer us some more resources. Geographically, the North Lake campus is the campus that where a trauma center is needed. Mm-hmm. So I'm not sure. I just don't know how.
Not very much is going to change, I would imagine. Well, it's just, you know, regardless of the ownership, I suppose, of the right. of the facility.
So. Right. Well, we hope that when the Franciscans merge with the Methodists, that they have a high love for providing trauma care to Gary. You know, I understand they're supposed to build a new hospital that's going to be in the city, and hopefully, you know, we'll be there fighting to have a nice, you know, state-of-the-art trauma center. That's all we have to say.
I was going to ask about that too, because we know that is supposedly one of the things in the works. If the changeover is finalized, the plans call for the new hospital to be built not close to the current location there in Gary, but actually closer to IU Northwest to the campus there, just off the Borman Expressway. So you'll have a new facility, and that in turn will make some improvements as well too. You've done what you can, I know, with the facility that you have, and it's a very, very good facility for what you've had to do in the upgrade, and obviously you are, I'm sure, are looking forward to what you get to do for a brand new facility.
Well, we're looking for it. We would love to have a new facility, like everything. You would like to have something new, but you got to admit, Methodist has a beautiful new emergency department at North Lake that they spent some time and some talent to bring to pass.
Yeah, I think we have done a really great job with the resources we currently have. We got a lot of odds stacked against us, but we have really worked to deliver the very best trauma care that we can with the resources that we have right now, and I think that we're knocking it out of the park.
Right. It's definitely a labor of love.
Absolutely.
It would seem, too, with the American College of Surgeons approving the accreditation here this summer for the facility that's opened up there in Gary, that they certainly think it's good. They think it's the best, certainly, for Northwest Indiana, and it's going to certainly keep you all very, very busy dealing with the emergencies as they come in. In the months and years ahead, I would imagine.
It's keeping us on our toes, that's for sure.
It definitely does. I mean, the American College Surgeons, if you can imagine every decision that has been made as a trauma center for the past 3 years being called on the carpet by elder surgeons who know all the good, the bad, and the evils of trauma. And every decision that has been made is up for question, and so it keeps you on your toes to stay on the cutting edge and to kind of to keep up with the trauma literature.
Now, having said that, what do your colleagues there at the hospital and other surgeons and other doctors here in Northwest Indiana have to say about the new Level 3 Trauma Center set up there at Methodist North Lake and trying to deal with Northwest Indiana's healthcare problems?
Well. Yeah, that's two different questions.
It's two really different questions.
Yeah, as far as the trauma center, we have nothing but praises. You know, I was thinking kind of what could I say about this when I was coming in. Prime example is anything new, people kind of are questionable. And one of the biggest things that I knew that we were taking hold as a trauma center was one of the times nurses on the floor, who was pretty much dead set of becoming the trauma center, just gave all type of roadblocks, excuses, and why not to become one. And I knew that we had buy-in from the hospital when she questioned me, and she says, you take care of people with traumatic injuries, but Dr. Rutland, you set nothing up for the mental injuries. And as a trauma surgeon, we are guilty of that. We take care of the body, and sometimes we forget the mind. And this was a patient who had a traumatic episode, and so she kind of helped set up a program that we can kind of talk to patients to get into them psychologists. This person is not even affiliated with Methodist for the most part, who understands that, you know, trauma can be mind altering as well.
So you are getting cooperation from other segments of the healthcare industries.
Yes.
Outside the hospital there in Northwest Indiana.
Absolutely. It's a huge component of being a trauma center. A lot of people have a misconception that trauma just occurs in the trauma bay of the emergency department, and that's really not true. A huge component of what we've done is we've reached out to the community to build really strong resources and community partnerships with people that we know will give us support. We could do injury prevention, we do outreach, and that was a really good example of how a community partner offered to help our traumatically injured patients. And so it's good trauma care. Great trauma care is really about, you know, from what happens at the time the patient's injured all along the time until they're discharged and every single step in between. So I'd like to clear that misconception up. It's not about the ER.
And including not just to the time they're discharged, you know, we're held just as responsible for getting patients to rehab centers, you know, in a quality time. You know, as a trauma surgeon, people think that I stay and I lurk around the ER waiting for a patient to come in. The ER is just where I meet my patient. I'm down there for usually, hopefully, no more than a golden hour of trauma. But I leave and we're with that patient for the rest through the ICUs, through the ORs, through the floors, and then until the patient sometimes goes to inpatient rehab and follow up. And, you know, the trauma surgeon acts as a quarterback, specifically when there's different body parts or different subspecialties that's involved. And so we just have to do that. And we say we have to do it, but it's like what we want to do. I keep saying it's a labor of love.
That's great. Trauma surgeon Dr. Reuben Rutland with us, as well as Jennifer Mullen, who's the trauma program coordinator. They both work at Memphis Hospital's North Lake campus in Gary. And, of course, the North Lake campus hospital is now officially verified as a Level 3 trauma center from the Committee on Trauma is the name of the group at the American College of Surgeons. Thank you very much for being with us today and for handling the questions here. I'm sure a lot of people had wondered about the new center, about its importance to Northwest Indiana, and how it's going to continue on here from forever, pretty much. And we appreciate you coming in to talk about today.
Thank you for having us.
You're listening to Regionally Speaking here on listener-supported Lakeshore Public Radio. What do you do when you drive over a pothole in your neighborhood? Well, you could report it to the city or town officials and hope that somebody comes out and fixes it soon. Or you could fix it yourself. At least that's what one Indianapolis man has been doing this year. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Annie Ropeek reports that his project reveals a lot about the different ways that residents and governments try to care for their communities.
Michael Warren is a one-person roads crew. He carries everything he needs on his bike: brooms, shovels, traffic cones, and goes looking for potholes.
This is one of the superficial ones. Like, you can tell it's shallow, but it covers a large surface area.
Warren cleans out the pothole and covers it with a mound of sticky black asphalt from a 50-pound bag. Next, he packs it down.
Of course, I hit pretty hard, so I feel like...
Warren grew up here, around the corner from the overgrown yards and abandoned houses on this block. He says these streets are low priority for the city.
And, you know, if they're not doing it, then we need to. I think we should, you know, get back to maintaining our communities and just take a primary role in that.
Betsy Whitmore is a spokeswoman for the Indianapolis Department of Public Works.
When I saw your email, I kind of went, really? Huh. That seems unsafe. I really want to talk to this person. I want to help out.
She says they're happy Michael Warren wants to help. She's worried about his safety, being in the road, and he technically needs a permit to work on city property. But most of all, she says,
we'd rather work with you so that we have records of what's been patched, and make sure that we are keeping all of our data.
That data tells the city where work's been done and where it needs to happen next. Whitmore wants citizens to report potholes to the Mayor's Action Center online. She says the DPW has filled more than 14,000 potholes through that system alone this year. Compare that to Michael Warren. He's filled about 70 potholes in a few months, spending $300 or $400 out of pocket. That's about $6 per pothole, while the city spends nearly $150 for each pothole reported by a citizen. And its average response time is about a week.
Sometimes these solutions don't come right away because we do have to manage resources pretty tightly. We don't have unlimited funding.
Michael Warren thinks, why wait? He wants to start a nonprofit so he can take donations to keep filling those little side street potholes while the city handles the main roads.
I think it's useful because it tells us how bad the situation is.
Ed Delaney is a state representative from Indianapolis. He's a Democrat who voted for the state's road funding plan, which will give communities more money to spend on what their roads need. And Delaney says that's his problem with Michael Warren's idea.
The reason we have a community is that we make decisions together. And so I don't think this concept can work and will cause a lot of chaos and disruption.
He says he understands the frustration in neighborhoods that feel ignored by city priorities, but he thinks fundraising to pay for improvements could have unintended consequences.
I don't want to be a witness to the conversation that says all the rich areas have nice streets now. That literally fractures a community.
Back on the Near East Side, cars slow to watch Michael Warren work. One driver gives him a thumbs up. Warren says once his neighbors see he isn't kidding, they support him.
You know, just because it's illegal doesn't mean it's wrong. Clearly this is a public good. This is a community service. This should be championed.
Warren is moving away soon to Virginia for a dream job with a software company. But his project, which he calls Open Source Roads, isn't stopping. He plans to put some of his new paycheck towards starting his nonprofit, and he'll keep patching potholes in his city, one by one. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Annie Ropeek in Indianapolis.
Last weekend's Chicago Air and Water Show showed that the South Shore was very, very busy, operating extra trains westbound to Millennium Station. And, of course, they also made the routes as well, with bicycles not permitted while the event was underway. Indiana's unemployment rate rose last month for the first time in 5 months, even though the state's private sector added jobs. The Indiana unemployment rate went up 0.1% to 3.1% in July. That's the first increase since February. But it still keeps the unemployment rate well below the national average and lower than all neighboring states. The Hoosier State's private sector had added 2,000 jobs in July. That was supported by the private educational and health services and manufacturing sectors. The construction sector took a notable tumble, though, shedding some 700 jobs in July. According to the state figures, even though there was private sector job growth, Indiana's labor force declined for the third month in a row. The labor force includes people who have a job or are actively looking for one, and growth in the labor sector, in turn, is typically viewed as a sign of optimism in the economy. There's a recent article in the online publication of The Conversation that is a conversation in itself, and asks the question whether Americans really should be allowed to deduct any charitable gifts from their taxes, and at least list them on their taxes. And let's find out more about that from the fellow who wrote the article. We have IUPUI Professor Patrick Rooney, who is also a member as well of the Center for Philanthropy at the IU Purdue Indianapolis. Thank you very much for being with us today, sir.
Thanks, Chris. Happy to be here.
Give us an idea of what prompted you to come up with the article that is in The Conversation, and your thoughts here behind making it easier for people to put charitable gifts on their taxes.
Well, so we were hired by Independent Sector, which is a nonprofit that does advocacy work for other charities throughout the United States. And they asked us to look into trying to measure what would be the impact of some of the proposals that have been discussed, such as lowering the top marginal tax rate and increasing the standard deduction, what impact that would have on philanthropic giving by households and individuals. And then, one of the things that wasn't part of the current law but has been part of the law in the past was to allow a kind of above-the-line or below-the-line deduction for charitable contributions by individuals so that even if you weren't an itemizer, you could still deduct your charitable gifts. And one of the reasons we were interested in that is more people give every year than vote, and so philanthropy is very democratic, small d. But we also wanted to see what would happen if we had the same tax incentives available to everybody, whether they were an itemizer or not. And so by democratizing the incentives to give, what impact that would have on philanthropy as well.
If you will give us an idea of where the tax system lies right now for those people who might be interested in making charitable gifts, and why it seems to be against anybody on say, the lower end of the economic spectrum.
Yeah, so right now, if you are a non-itemizer, that is, you don't itemize your tax deductions when you file your tax returns, then it costs you basically a dollar to donate a dollar. So mm-hmm. You're not disadvantaged, but you're not given any tax incentive to do so. And The charitable tax deduction has been a part of the tax code for 100 years this year, and almost as long as the tax, you know, as we've had taxes. And so there's been a recognition that charitable donations play an important part in how we address our civil society needs around the country and around the world. But if you're an itemizer, and let's say you're in the top marginal tax bracket, which today is 39.6%, if you know, let's round that to 40%. Mm-hmm. So if you donate a dollar, you get a 40% tax deduction. So it costs you 60 cents to give a dollar as for an itemizer in the top tax bracket. Whereas if you're a non-itemizer, it costs you a dollar to give a dollar. And so it does provide an incentive. Now, people don't give just because of the tax incentive, and I want to really stress that, because that would be irrational to do. People, if you only cared about yourself, then you'd always be better off just keeping the money and spending it on yourself or your loved ones. But the tax incentives provide, the tax deductions provide an incentive to give at all and to give more for those who do give. And we find that it does make a difference.
We see that, I guess, there are a number of reasons. That, of course, there are obvious reasons, we hope, like public broadcasting, for example, why people should be making some kind of charitable gift to help out in here. But I'm sure there are probably a lot of areas as well that get discouraged from receiving any charitable gifts because of the way the system is now, isn't it?
Well, yeah, and I want to say that, yeah, so public broadcasting, whether it's NPR or PBS, you know, are certainly legal tax-deductible entities and have received lots of small donor gifts over the years and have received from some very famous large ones over the years as well. And, you know, I think that the tax deductibility provides some marginal or incremental incentive for individuals and families to give at all, and for those who are giving to give more. Now, that said, it's the other households don't have, I would say they don't have a disincentive, but they don't have any tax incentives mm-hmm. to give more if they're not an itemizer.
Okay. We know that during the past campaign, then presidential candidate Donald Trump talked about making some changes. What do you see the way things look now that we should be putting out there to safeguard any charitable giving that's offered?
Well, I think this is, you know, one of the challenges, and there are other reasons for these proposals, and so I don't want to say that they're all bad ideas per se, mm-hmm. But what we looked at was what would be the impact on charity. So, you know, what we know is that if you lower the top marginal tax rate from 39.6% to 35%, which is been proposed, that would reduce giving by charitable giving by just under 1%. So that has a negative impact. It's not huge, but it's small, but it's negative, and it's real. The bigger one is the proposal to more than double the standard deduction. So right now, about 30% of households are itemizers, and under the proposed reforms, the number of itemizers would fall to 5% or 3% of households, depending on the actual law that's passed. Well, what we found is that by doubling the standard deduction, that would reduce charitable giving by almost 4%. And, you know, that's a very material amount. You might say that's not the end of the world, but that's 4% per year going on forever. And so I think that that's, that's something to be concerned about. That's more than the amount of increase in charitable giving in most years. And so, I think it would be a material loss. Another proposal that the Trump campaign has promulgated is to have the repeal of the estate tax. We did not look into that as a part of this research, but prior research has suggested that repeal of the estate tax would reduce charitable bequest giving by between 12 and 22%. So, again, that's hard to estimate because you give every year, but you only die once, right?
Mm-hmm.
So
right. It's
more difficult to estimate those impacts. But, again, all of these things would have a negative impact on philanthropy. Now, it might you know, there might be motivations for doing them for other reasons, but we just wanted to alert people to the negative impact. On the other hand, if you expanded the charitable itemizer for charitable deduction for non-itemizers, we estimated that that would increase giving by 4.3%. So that would have a very positive and stimulative effect on giving because, again, that would create an incentive for all households to give from a tax perspective, regardless of whether or not they itemize.
So it sounds like this is just one of the many reasons why we hope that the Trump administration will turn out some kind of tax reform proposal here before too long. We'd like to see certainly what would affect our taxes, we pay have to pay to Uncle Sam, but also affecting these charitable gifts that we like to give as well, too. We've been talking with Professor Patrick Rooney. He teaches at Indiana University, Purdue University, Indianapolis. He's also a member of the Center for Philanthropy there on the UPUI campus. Professor Rooney, thank you for taking time to talk with us about this, and we hope we do get some indication from Washington what they're going to do soon as far as the tax structure and how we can be able to safeguard our charitable gifts that we do give to whatever cause it may happen to be. Thank you for being with us today to talk about it.
Thanks, Chris. Thanks for having me.
Miguel Molina is a Northwest Indiana resident who is involved in what is called the People's Voice Project, a statewide project with a goal to reach what he called low propensity voters.
I'm originally from Mexico, but I migrated to the United States. So I'm one of those documented students here in Indiana. And for me, last year's election was very tragic because of the uncertainty about DACA. And so that was a wake-up call, and it allowed me to know that we need to do something to change the way the current political landscape is here in Indiana. So with this project that we're working on, is we're trying to target five different counties, which includes Lake County, Elkhart, LaPorte, St. Joseph, and Porter County. Mm-hmm. We want to make sure that we hold the elected officials accountable and push for policies that are more inclusive for the community, provide more opportunities for all people that are living here in Indiana. Coming from an undocumented background, I understand that there's a lot of limitation when it comes to undocumented students trying to obtain an education. So that's not part of the Hoosiers values that we have here in Indiana. And we're just trying to make sure that we create a coalition building and get all the organizations around Indiana together so we can go for a large-scale a voter registration campaign and have an impact on the 2018 coming election.
The mission statement from the People's Voice mentions low propensity voters have been ignored and their voices lost. And obviously you feel that's a major concern here, in particular in Northwest Indiana.
Yes. And this project actually, it's not completely original. It has been tried out in different parts of the United States. In California, there's a lot of nonprofit organizations like CHIRLA who are working to make sure that low-propensity voters, which are especially the Latino voter, the African-American community, and low-income workers are the ones that are usually ignored because people don't think that they're going to vote. Even the Democrats ignore them. And so it has come to be proven that if you take those people out to vote and you help them and educate them about the voting process, they will be able to vote. New people that have their residence and now are U.S. citizens, they want to vote too and participate in the democratic process, but they don't know how to. But with this project, we're going to build a relationship with the voters and hope for them to vote on the 2018 election by letting them know this is why it's important to vote for a treasurer. This is why it's important to vote for your township person. And any other important elected official that they need to elect.
I know that you work very closely with a fellow named Gregorio Chavez, who works basically out of the South Bend area. He's actually your mentor. How did you get involved with working with the organization through him? What has he taught you, and what has he taught other people as well, too, to get the People's Choice program moving here in Northern Indiana in particular?
Yeah, meeting Mr. Chavez has been a blessing. And the way that we met is like he was at a LULAC meeting. Mm-hmm. And so Sam Santellas, who's a director of La Casa de Amistad, I wanted to talk to him to ask for an internship opportunity, which he did give me one, too. And that's where I met Mr. Chavez at a LULAC conference. He started talking about his project, and he had more than 20 years worth of research with him. And he just went, okay, this is the Latino population. Do you know look at that. This is 10,000 Latinos. Do you know from all of them how many they vote? Not even 1,000. And so, like, he's right. There's a lot of Latinos in Lake County. There's a lot of Latinos in Elkhart County. There's a lot of Latino in Porter County, but they're not voting sufficiently. So somebody needs to go to their door and let them know, hey, we really need you to go out and vote. And that's what we're going to focus. We want to identify leadership here in Indiana and hope that they too can do some of the work, especially if they have a large base of people that they are being followed by.
Now, you mentioned some of the counties here in Northwest Indiana in particular that you want to help target, in particular with the People's Choice Project. But are there any other counties in Indiana that the overall statewide group is focusing on as well? Are there maybe in central Indiana or in southern Indiana? So to give an idea to our listeners, how many people are really being sought after to be part of the effort to not only educate voters, but also to get people registered to vote?
We estimate that we needed around 200 to 250 people to help us out in order for us to be successful. Why? Because we want to develop teams of five, and those teams of five at least have one Spanish speaker with them. Mm-hmm. And in those teams of five, they will be able to cover more ground together. And that's an idea that was developed by Mr. Chavez because he also worked on the census. And in order for them to reach their goals in doing the census work, they moved out in teams of 20s, of course, but even larger. But with this idea, we also see that we'll be able to target the low propensity voters. And we want to coordinate, too, with other organizations, especially the Democratic Party, hopefully in the future, too. So like that, we won't be knocking on the same doors. We want to make this very strategic as we can. But the only way we can do that is by making sure that we reach out to all the leaders from all the organizations and we sit down at a table and have a discussion about how we're going to move forward with Indiana. It will be tough, but it's very possible, and it's been done before in different areas. It's just a matter of building a relationship with the voters. And once they have that trust with you, they will know that, oh, yes, this person is right. You know, voting would only take less than an hour of my time. I should definitely do it because we want a person that we can hold accountable and that will represent our values of opportunities and inclusiveness for all.
Miguel Molina, who is a Northwest Indiana volunteer for the 2017-2018 People's Voice Project. This is Regionally Speaking. Residents of East Chicago got some good news about their drinking water over the weekend, but Michael Puente tells us that there's still some concern about lead contamination.
Recent tests show the water from the city's water system is safe, but old lead-lined water pipes into people's homes are causing some tests to come back with elevated levels for lead. Robert Kaplan, Region 5 Acting Administrator for the U.S. EPA, says there's a simple fix.
The water in East Chicago is like the water in Milwaukee, is like the water in any other city where you have lead lines. So the best thing that you can do to protect your family is use a filter. The filter is something that reduces lead to non-detect or near non-detect.
The city of East Chicago will be replacing the water lines to 400 homes in the coming weeks. I'm Michael Puente.
The Ball State University Center for Business and Economic Research looked into the issues of two forces that could affect the workforce of the future here in Indiana, automation and offshoring jobs, as it's called. The center's executive director, economist Michael Hicks, says that the study compared these job risks in urban areas to those in rural counties.
A couple years ago, we published a study on the relative impact of automation or technology change and trade on manufacturing job losses, finding that it was mostly automation. About between 8 and 9 out of every 10 jobs in manufacturing that were lost between 2000 and 2010 were lost to automation. And that study got a lot of attention because of the political cycle that occurred after we published it, sort of a serendipitous for us. But what we really wanted to do here was to try to understand better what was happening in terms of automation and trade, where those job losses may occur geographically and across income, across educational attainment, and then to see how they linked to urbanization, the movement of households to cities, and then try to provide some either warning to rural places or small towns or to, you know, people with master's degree in technology, whatever the results were. And that's our goal in this, is to better understand this, what is driving a lot of the political discussion today.
I understand that in going through all of this, the team and in the report put out, I guess, some very specific counties in Indiana. As you mentioned, some of them are rural, small counties in particular, that probably need to be rethinking economic development, in particular because of the automation and the offshoring threats as well, too. Tell us about how the impact is here in Indiana.
Well, you know, as a large manufacturing state, Indiana is at a little bit more risk of loss to automation, although many of Indiana's manufacturing workplaces are very heavily automated today, and for trade, but both because you can't really export a massage, which is a service, but you can export the manufacture of a hip joint. And we're a very large agricultural state, as is true throughout the Midwest, and we are a very large exporter of manufactured goods. So those two areas tend to be at risk. And if you just look at the sort of counties that are at big risk in Indiana, out of 3,100-odd U.S. counties, LaGrange County, Indiana, Switzerland County, Indiana, Blackford County, are all three at very high risk of automation losses. And LaGrange also for offshore ability, but also Elkhart County and Hamilton County and DeKalb County, all for offshore ability. And so, being a small medium sized state, to have more than a half dozen counties out of the top 50 in terms of job losses across both of these activities is very worrisome, I think.
Mm-hmm. I noticed that Northwest Indiana counties are not necessarily included in that, although I'm sure that there probably are some risks there, in particular for automation, I would think here. Any reason why it just seemed to turn out that way, at least in this report?
Yeah, no, it appeared to be random at first. You can look at the map, and what we found was there's a very strong clustering of both offshore ability and automation. So if you're in a county that has a high risk of job losses, say half your jobs are at risk of being lost due to automation, you're typically surrounded by four or five counties that are exactly like you. And so it's really the industrial structure, the distribution of occupations across regions that make it at great risk for automation. For trade, it is a little bit more different. You know, automation's taking, as we'll talk about, some particular types of jobs and some particular types of educational levels. Offshore ability hits across all levels of income, aggress all levels of education. And so you also see, you know, places like Hamilton County, which you would think, you know, Fishers, Noblesville, Carmel is probably not very susceptible to this, is also a place where there are a number of jobs that could be outsourced. And these are in, you know, things like call center jobs and back office financial services, people doing software production, which could be done as simply and easily and a lot less expensively in, say, Bangalore, India, or Beijing.
Mm-hmm. What does this study that's been put together, by the way, not only by the CBER, but also in cooperation with the Rural Policy Institute Center for State Policy, what does this report bode for what counties, if they are not already doing it, but they should be doing it to better prepare for these threats, if not already happening for them, of offshoring jobs as well as the automation problems?
Well, I mean, the big worry that we have, in addition to the fact that it's geographic, is that it looks like, in particular, automation is going to clobber households at the lower levels of income. So if you look at our study on Ball State's website, the highest 10% of occupations that could be automated are earning about $36,000 a year. These are high school graduate jobs. The lowest 10% are earning about $84,000 a year. So we see both geography affecting where job losses are and also income and educational attainment. And so that led us to some policy recommendations for state and local levels. The first one is, you know, seriously rethink the way we're doing economic development. I mean, much of the resources and all the rhetoric right now are targeting, you know, trying to lure jobs from somewhere else when those, even if you get them, those jobs that can be moved from place to place are unlikely to remain here in Indiana once we've spent, you know, tens of millions of dollars on them. And then secondly, your listeners will probably understand is, you know, to ensure education is general enough that men and women after high school can be retooled at several times over the course of their life or adapt to the new technological change that's an inherent part of living in the 21st century.
That's Ball State University economist Michael Hicks. It's Monday. That means it's time for another edition of Eye on the Arts with John Kane.
Joining me for this edition of Eye on the Arts is a familiar guest, Kirk Muspratt, the music director and conductor of the Northwest Indiana Symphony Orchestra. Welcome back, Kirk.
Hi, John.
I see you have your materials all laid out before you.
Oh, I'm prepared.
That's the number one goal.
Be prepared.
You're prepared to talk about the symphony's historic 76th season. Doesn't have quite the same ring to it as 75th.
But oh, I don't know. 76 trombones.
76
I love
trombones
it
is. So what do these 76 trombones consist of?
Well, actually, it leads right into our first concert, which is Brass Transit, and it is the entire music of the rock band Chicago with orchestra, of course.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, Brass Transit has trombones in it, certainly. It's the only band that's licensed to play the music of Chicago with orchestra, and I think they're wonderful, and I love the music of Chicago.
I do too.
So that's the opening concert on September 16th at the Star Theater.
It reminds me of being at parties in basements in the 1970s.
It does?
Yes.
You're a luckier person than me. It reminds me of band camp.
Oh, the music of Chicago?
Yes, because that's where I discovered it.
Of course.
I heard the older kids playing their records.
Well, you were more musical than I was. I didn't. And I didn't play band instruments, so I played the violin. Anyway, moving on.
Yes.
So that's how we're starting the season. And from there?
Mikado. Which is at Bethel. And it's full chorus, wonderful, fantastic cast. Some costumes. We'll have some umbrellas. There'll be lots of, I mean, it's hilarious, first of all. Super titles, all the silly stories about British government, which is sort of apropos of the day.
Mm-hmm.
And that's our first classical concert, and that's in October. And John, can I mention, in October, on the 24th, we're going to have our very last education concert that will ever take place in the Star Theater. And it's all about Latin and Hispanic music.
Mm-hmm.
So it's going to be really a cool concert.
Yeah,
I hope the teachers will come.
Yeah, and it is. It's the last opportunity for our teachers to bring their kids to this gigantic local professional theater.
Yeah.
And find out what that's about. And it's a lot cheaper than hauling them to Chicago to a professional theater.
Without doubt. And you know the letters that the kids write to me, you've seen them, John. They talk about the experience of, oh my gosh, being in that theater and all the red seats and how comfortable they were. And
it's impressive.
Yeah, when they're you know, that little, of course, it's very impressive.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So then, of course, sadly, we come to our Holiday Pops concert.
The concert we sold out last year, and it will be our last concert ever in the Star Theater.
Yeah.
And do you want to talk about the party at all, John?
Well, we're planning a party before the concert that night. This is on December 7th, which is actually our birthday, Pearl Harbor Day.
Mm-hmm.
And we were extremely successful last year with a fundraising campaign, asking people to join our 75th anniversary club at the $75 level per person, and we netted about $25,000 on this campaign and had a party before our final Pops concert back in April. Well, that was before we found out there's going to be no more Star Plaza Theater. So we want to take advantage of the momentum of that campaign and do a 76 Trombones Club. That's what we're calling it, the 76 Trombones Club. And for a $76 per person contribution, you will be invited to this pre-concert party immediately before our final Pops concert, the Holiday Pops concert on December 7th.
Great. And last year, the party was a hoot.
Oh, my gosh. It's going to have the Jeff Brown Trio. There will be food. You get to meet Kirk, and you get to meet the musicians, and it's a lot of fun. So so there's that. And there's also the possibility that we might be adding an additional Pops concert, Holiday Pops concert, on Wednesday of that week.
Because it's so popular.
Because it sold out last year, and this will be people's last opportunity to come hear us at the Star Plaza Theater. So we might be adding, if we sell a lot, depending on ticket sales, but we might be adding a performance on Wednesday, the night before the final concert.
Cool.
Yeah.
Thank you for telling us.
John Kane with Eye on the Arts and Kirk Muspratt with the Northwest Indiana Symphony Orchestra talking about the upcoming 76th season of the orchestra. Hope you'll join us on Regionally Speaking tomorrow. We have Tom Pappas with the Portage City Veterans Committee talking about veterans affairs issues. Also, we'll find out more about the dedication this Friday of IU Northwest's new Arts and Sciences building. And State Representative Scott Peleth will be with us as well. We hope you'll join us.